It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here.
Please join me in an attitude of prayer. Let us seek to confront evil. Evil isn't as powerful as it sometimes seems. Both the evil around us and the evil within us don't get their force from a moral power, but from an unholy hunger combined with the ability to exploit us for their own selfish ends. Let us remember that we can overpower most evil by staying grounded in life, in love, and in an unshakable sense of our own sacred worth. For we are children of the universe, the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself, the sons and daughters of God. Living out of that identity is living in the light, and evil hates the light. Let us not be tricked into feeling unworthy of the great gift of life and love that connect us with our core and the core of all other living things. One of evil's worst tricks is making us doubt our own worth. So let us never forget that we are as worthy as everyone else, that we are beloved of this place and beloved by God, by all the gods of life, truth, and light. Let us remember this. Remember this. Amen.
It's Halloween, and I want to talk with you about vampires. Not those unimaginative literalist suckers who just want to drink blood. I mean the far more numerous and the far more dangerous kind, known as psychic vampires, who can suck the life out of you. These people, in their more extreme forms, are also called sociopaths by psychologists. They're people who can do immense psychological and sometimes physical harm to others without ever feeling any guilt, which is what makes them so dangerous. We need to recognize them and know how to protect ourselves from the psychic vampires both around us and also within us. For while only a few have a truly sociopathic character, we can all slip into this behavior, and it never serves us or anyone else well. It's about the lack of a conscience, the lack of a capacity for feeling guilty when we demean or harm someone or turn them into mere things to serve our wishes. And that's a bad thing. The very first personality disorder recognized by psychiatry. And by personality disorder, it means a permanent, untreatable character disorder. It's very serious. The very first personality disorder recognized by psychiatry was guiltlessness. That's at the core of what they mean by sociopathy. Sociopaths are now estimated to be about 4% of the U.S. population. That's one in 25 people, an incredibly high number. It means that within the roughly 2.5 million people here in Travis County, There are about 100,000 of them. They walk among us. Or that right here in this church, of about 600 members and over 900 in the whole community, there would be two or three dozen. Now, of course, there aren't any here. We have these invisible filters in front of all the doors. And it's a good thing we do. Not all life-draining vampires are sociopaths, though all are destructive. They're dangerous because these are extreme, sometimes incurable, forms of selfishness, which is the cardinal sin of every religion I know of. You really don't matter to them unless you serve them and do it their way. As this goes on, some of these people will feel more and more familiar, and you'll have faces coming to mind. Your wishes, your needs, your spirit, your soul really don't matter to them. You're a piece in a game they are playing and have perhaps played all of their lives. If they have played it all of their lives, you're not going to change them. Stories of psychic vampires are some of the oldest stories we have. They go back into our prehistory, according to one source, probably 6,000 years and more. So people who live by draining the life out of others have existed in all cultures throughout history. It's part of the human condition. They can be immensely charismatic and seductive, and we seem fascinated by them in that disguise. In fact, we prefer that disguise. As part of my homework for this sermon, this was fairly strange homework for this sermon, besides reading or rereading two books, I watched 7 movies about this character. One was George Cukor's 1944 classic Gaslight, which I'd never seen. It's a stunning movie about a pure sociopathic character, done extremely well. But the other 6 were all vampire movies. And as far as I know, there have only been 6 vampire movies made in the last 85 years that anyone seems to know about. In 2 of them, both named Nosferatu, the monster is presented the way Bram Stoker originally wrote the monster in Dracula. Most of us don't know this. The monster is presented without any charm at all. Just an absolutely repulsive, grotesque, hungry evil. Not surprisingly, both these movies in 1922 and 1979 were commercial failures. We don't want to see it that way. We like our evil sugar-coated. If you want to see these movies, I'd recommend the 1922 silent film. It's much better. The 4 commercially successful films were the 4 films where the vampire is charming and seductive. These include Bela Lugosi's 1931 film, the 1979 version, very interesting movies, where Frank Langella plays a wonderfully seductive vampire, and Francis Ford Coppola's 1992 version called Bram Stoker's Dracula, where charisma and seduction are everywhere. The most recent one, the 1994 movie Interview with the Vampire, capitalizes on the sexy charisma, though it's about seduction rather than sex. If you doubt this, just remember that Tom Cruise, Brad Pitt, and Antonio Banderas are cast as the male vampires. And an 11-year-old Kirsten Dunst is cast as a beguiling child vampire who will say, "I'm hungry and the city awaits." Yes. Children can be vampires too, and from very early ages. It can start early in life and is found in all professions, including psychotherapy, ministry, law enforcement, teaching, parenting, everywhere. The 2 books I read were both written by women psychologists, and both of them made a point of saying that sociopaths are numerous in the psychotherapy field. Now, we now have quite a bit of empirical data on this sociopath stuff, to take it out of the mythic realm of just talking about vampires, by inserting a series of questions to measure along the what they call the psychopathic deviant scale. Isn't this attractive? By inserting those into the MMPI test, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory test, psychologists have collected data from hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions by now. That's where the data come from, that say that about 4% of the U.S. society are sociopaths. The author of one of these books relates stories of an 8-year-old son of very wealthy parents who used to blow up frogs for sport. As she went on with this story, I wondered if she was intentionally making this a story about George W. Bush. As many of you know, that's part of his childhood, blowing up frogs for sport. So I don't know whether this was a hidden political slap in here or just the coincidence of another boy. She also told the story of a psychologist who used her power to do great psychological harm to patients who seemed too smart or too pretty. And she got away with it for more than a decade. These are people for whom the life force, or even the life of others, simply doesn't matter. It's about control, persuasion, winning, manipulating, and the game never ends. It's hard to believe how quickly this vampire thing can be turned on and off. For instance, it's almost impossible for me to believe, maybe it's hard for you to believe too, that the serial murderer, Ted Bundy, who murdered more than 20 women, was also a very successful suicide prevention counselor. It's about persuasion and control and winning. Winning at what is secondary. In all the mythic lore, there are no stories of vampires ever committing suicide. Once they start feeding, they will continue until they're stopped. Why do they do it? This is really interesting to me. It looks like it may be about half genetic and half cultural, though almost none to do with childhood experiences. Very unusual. The Texas Adoption Project is where some of this data comes from. It has followed adopted children for over 35 years. It reports that where scores on this psychopathic deviant scale are concerned, individuals resemble their birth mothers, whom they've never met, much more than they do the adoptive parents who raised them. So the person's tendency to possess certain sociopathic characteristics is in the blood. This isn't about mothers. It just means that we have a lot more data on the mothers who gave the children up for adoption than we do about the fathers. If it's inherited, it would have come equally from either of them. That's up to half, they say. Where's the other half come from? It's curious. They find no data linking sociopathy either with childhood abuse, which I would have suspected, or with attachment disorders, and say the kinds of personalities that result aren't the same. But it does look like our culture helps create sociopaths. Now, this is an interesting statement that needs some data. In America, the guiltless manipulation of other people blends in with social expectations, capitalist expectations, a lot more than it would in Asian countries, for instance. Asian nations have traditionally taught that we're interconnected and that we owe something to others, both through their religions of Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, and through their secular cultures. And in Asian nations, the percentage of sociopaths are between 0.04% and 0.13%, which is 1/30th to 1/100th of ours. That's a big difference. A lot of charismatic leaders are such vampires, and they should be easy to spot, though people seem not to spot them. You have a charismatic vampire any time a leader or teacher sets himself up to be a conduit of wisdom, truth, or divinity that's not directly available to lesser mortals like you. This applies to religious or political leaders, for instance, who believe God has spoken directly to them, but not to those who disagree with them. Most of the vampires we meet aren't this dramatic or this bigger than life. They're kind of ordinary, though psychologists who work with their victims will tell you they do immense and lifelong harm. I knew a young woman who was a very bright girl, considerably brighter than her sociopathic boyfriend. When she graduated from college at the top of her class, her C-average boyfriend said, "Well, sweetie, it's a good thing that you're pretty smart because you'll never be very pretty." That's a vampire. Don't underestimate it. That's a vampire sucking life out of his own girlfriend. When I heard this story, especially since I knew the girl, I wished it had ended differently. I wished it had ended with her telling him, "Look, Bucky Beaver, beauty's only skin deep, like you." But it didn't end that way, and it often doesn't end that way. His remark took life from her, and she didn't get that life back for many, many years. Then there are the more passive-aggressive vampires who make others serve their desires by hanging around like bats, poisoning the air, making the place toxic until people finally decide, "My God, give them what they want so we can have some peace." You recognize this. But those are vampires. And the reason they are is because they don't care at all or even notice the wishes, the needs, or the values of anyone else. All others exist to serve their wishes. This has to begin sounding more familiar, doesn't it? Some of these vampires, goblins, and demons do it through outright power and charisma. Others do it through evoking pity, which makes people let them get away with murder. Pitying someone can blind us to the fact that they use that pity to paralyze us while they behave badly again and again. Pity is like the anesthetic that lets the operation happen. One of the psychologists writing on this says that the combination of consistently bad, selfish, demeaning behavior with frequent plays for your pity is as close to a warning mark on a sociopath's forehead as you're ever going to get. Now, the best-known example of this has got to be the battering husband who sits at the table crying, head in hands after beating her, apologizing, saying it will never happen again. But it will. The pity play is a tactic. It's used to wipe the slate clean so they can begin the whole cycle of hurting and repenting again. And they repent well. The crocodile tears come not from deep feeling, but from a deep and probably unconscious kind of scheming. So how do you spot vampires? What can you do? The clearest way to know that you've been in the presence of a vampire or a sociopath is a feeling of shameful insufficiency. I think that's the best insight into this that I've read. We should look around for a psychic vampire whenever we feel that we are somehow flawed, not because of what we've done, but because of who we inherently are or are not. We feel we're not good enough, or thin, or smart, or sexy enough. Well, sweetie, it's a good thing you're pretty smart, because you'll never be very pretty. You can feel life being sucked out by that statement. Whenever we experience this feeling of shameful insufficiency, we've probably been the victim of a psychic vampire. They can be anyone. Parents, relatives, friends, teachers, ministers, psychologists, spouses, politicians, anyone. I have a mental image of a sociopath that's always been helpful to me. Maybe it'll be useful to you. It's one I learned from a psychologist that I knew when I was 21 years old. We were talking about a very pretty woman we both knew, who was a striking example of this style. This was before they used the word sociopathy in psychology. She was so quick, witty, seductive, and manipulative. At one point I said to him, "Look, you're a psychologist, can't you people fix her?" And he said, "You have the wrong picture. You're picturing people like this sort of like a very nice house, which, however, has a big gap in its foundation, and you're wondering if the gap can't just somehow be bricked up." And I said, "Yes, that's right." He said, "No. Instead, imagine a building several stories tall that is very strong and attractive, with a foundation that goes fairly deep, but which is built at a 20-degree angle. It's stronger than most of the buildings around it, but it's dangerous for anyone who runs into it the wrong way." So you've probably been around a psychic vampire or a sociopath, especially if they're 1 in 25 people. My God, that's a lot. If you leave feeling deeply unworthy, insufficient, and flawed, ask what on earth put that feeling into you, where it came from. You weren't born with it. Or if you're with people who have this cycle of demeaning or vicious behavior followed by dramatic apologies that let you feel sorry for them so they can begin the cycle again, back off and look at it. Or if that passive kind are there that hang around like bats, making the atmosphere toxic until you finally give in. Well, that's depressing. Now the question that's in every vampire movie: how do you kill a vampire? Understand, I'm not talking about physically killing anyone. Or anything. I don't want to see the population of black cats go down. None of this. Just talking about ending the ability of this trait to drain your life and the life of others. And I don't just mean other people. We also fall into this drive for power over others at all costs. One psychiatrist I've read has said, "I'm convinced that we enter the world seeking love, and when we don't find love, we settle for power." I think that's just right. So killing an inner vampire would mean we need to go back to the moment when we couldn't find love and settled for exploitation. There's a lot of this in the fight some couples have, as marriage counselors can tell you. We settle for power and vengeance when we can't find love. Now, the ancient myths about vampires are really very helpful in their guided, coded way in telling us how to kill vampires. They say that the most desirable woods from which to fashion the stake to kill a vampire — remember, I don't mean real, no stakes. The most desirable woods, and I thought this odd, so I had to look the woods up — are hawthorn and ash. Hawthorn is a tree that blooms very early in the spring. So it signals the beginning of spring's rebirth from winter's death. And that's a regenerative moment that would be odious to a vampire. And ash is the wood of Yggdrasil, the tree of Norse mythology, the tree from which all life was created. So the enemy of the destroyer of life is life itself, renewed and refocused around a living center inside of us. And that brings us back to church. This is where honest religion can help, because its job is to help us find and reconnect with healthy life and to be filled with it and live out of it and serve it. When we're connected to what's holy and gives us life, we are immune to the power of vampires, because the seductive vampire has nothing to offer us that we need. That's why I'd wished that young woman could have said, "My God, Bucky Beaver, you should know that beauty's only skin deep like you." If you have that distance from it and some wit to go with it, it's better than crosses and garlic. So if we can connect with our life force, our psychological immune system, it's an interesting thing. In the West, they call that life force chi. In the East, I mean. In the West, we call it our immune system. Makes it far too scientific and far less warm and available. But if we can connect with our psychological immune system, we do have things to keep unhealth away. Then we're far more invulnerable to psychic predators, because what they offer is trumped by the life we already have. We already have what they want and don't have. Some of you have experienced this when you were in a bad relationship or a toxic relationship and finally came to your senses or stood up to one of these predators. There's a great story told by one of the authors I read about this. It kind of counters that amazing scene. If you saw the movie Interview with the Vampire, the scene of that 11-year-old actress, Kirsten Dunst, really is stunning. She really is quite frightening as a little vampire saying, "I am hungry and the city awaits." This is a story about how to defeat vampires. It's a story about a bully on a bus of middle schoolers who was sitting next to a retarded boy, picking on him, making fun of him, something he'd done often. But this day, there was a young girl sitting in the seat behind him. She leaned forward and said, "That's mean. Quit it." He sneered at her and called her a name or two, but he got up and moved. Confronting a predator is like exposing them to the sunlight, and vampires hate sunlight. Why, as we grow up, do we so often lose the courage to confront the predators in our lives, our relationships, our institutions, and our government? The people who habitually use others, who put others down and demean people or demean whole classes of people, why do we lose the courage to stand up and say, "That's mean, quit it," to say it and mean it and not back down? It's one of the sadder facts of growing up. Here was a girl on the school bus who knew she was worth something. She knew that her friend was worth something, and she wouldn't let a big bully pretend otherwise. And humor has a lot of power to dispel the vampire's strength, because it's hard to be intimidated when you're laughing. But if we can remember a few basic holy facts, we can be protected from vampires. In the older movies in vampires, it was always part of the story. This was Bram Stoker's story. It was always part of the story that crosses and the consecrated host, the little wafer, and religious symbols were anathema to vampires. What this meant was that they were seen as the symbols of what's holy. It's interesting, if you watch all these vampire movies — I'm not recommending that you watch all these vampire movies, but if you do, watch them in order — By the time you get to the movies from 1979 on, they're downplaying all these things. The cross really doesn't work very much. Some of this is a measure of how religion has lost respect in the last 50 years. And by the time you get to the interview with the vampire, they just say flat out, this is just mythology invented by Bram Stoker 100 years ago. Those things don't mean a thing. But what they were about that does mean something is that they were symbols of that holy force, that life force that can be available to all of us. And those absolutely can make you immune and can help destroy the vampiric traits in you and others. We need to remember that we're a child of the universe, a child of God, and that it really doesn't get much better than that. We're not inadequate. We're not broken. We are not in need of someone else's special redemption. And boy, if we are, there are people who will line up to redeem us for a price. We are loved. And love, fired full bore, will blow away the nastiest vampire like a blast of sunlight. It's not too hard to make most monsters vanish, really. Sunlight kills mildew, and it does a good job on most demons and goblins, too. But first it takes being aware of them. It takes the courage to confront them, like that great heroine who said, "That's really mean. Quit it." In the movie The Wizard of Oz, the monster is dissolved in an unusual way. The Wicked Witch of the West is finally destroyed when a determined girl throws water on her and she melts. I don't think it was the water that did it. I think the water was just stage business. I think what dissolved the witch was a girl having the courage to confront her face to face without blinking or backing down. It took a girl who was not afraid. That trick looks kind of like magic, but it isn't magic. Ambrose Bierce, in his Devil's Dictionary, defines a ghost as the outward and visible sign of an inward fear. One lesson of Halloween is that most of our ghosts are outward and visible signs of our inward fears. Other lessons of Halloween are that ghosts vanish when enough light is shined upon them, and that fears, once faced, can be transformed into possibilities. On second thought, maybe that is magic, after all. Happy Halloween, precious people.